The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi there. Welcome back once again to I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you by my good self, Chris Difford, and the wonderful charity Help Musicians. I'm in very good company today with the frontman of the band The Lottery Winners. A band from Greater Manchester, they were discovered by record company legend Seymour Stein. They've come such a long way in a short time, with three albums, two of them reaching number one, including their latest, Coco. They've collaborated with people so diverse, like Stephen Fry, Sean Ryder, and the wonderful Boy George. So please welcome the inspiring and effervescent Tom Rylance. That's Tom with a capital H.
I'm recording here now.
Cool. We're all recording. Hey, Tom, welcome to this podcast for Help Musicians. How are you?
Hello, mate. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me on this. I've had a look at some of your other guests. Ridiculous. You're really scraping the barrel now with me.
You got it sometimes. I'm always at the bottom of the barrel, so it's very nice.
Lovely Telecaster behind you there. What year is that?
Okay, so that's made in Spain, and it's a recent addition to my collection, and it's based on the original makings of a Telecaster, so it's a very light wood. And they're called Nachos guitars, and they're from Spain, and I can't recommend them enough. They're brilliant.
Ah, it looks beautiful.
And so do you in that hat.
Thank you. I am very beautiful. I'm a beautiful man.
What's it like having number one albums? I've never had a number one album. What does that feel like?
It's not for everyone, mate. it feels mad. It's like I crave affirmation. I really do. Like, that's probably the reason that I get up on stage, because I need to be like clapped at and stuff. So to have like a trophy with a literal number one on it,
yeah,
it's quite a physical manifestation of affirmation there for me. I can just look at and go, I'm great.
Okay. And where does that affirmation have to come from?
People, I think. People liking me. That's all I've ever wanted. Oh, God, we got to this fast.
Yeah.
What about the small talk? Christ.
I'm not into that.
Should we go straight to the childhood trauma?
Yeah, no, like you, I mean, I had problems when I was at school and no one was interested in what I was doing. So I used to have to sit at the back and roll my own bogeys and stuff like that.
Bogeys, like even saying that word makes me feel nauseous. There's something about it, like even the thought of anything coming from someone's nose just makes me feel so sick instantly. So you've made me feel very uncomfortable there, Chris.
I'm sorry. Have some fruit.
And fruit and anything healthy.
Is songwriting a bit of a therapy for you, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. It's my only one, the main one. So I think I will kind of tap into the emotions of a situation or just something that I'm feeling. And then when I write it, that kind of feels like the therapy bit, like talking about it. But then when you get to play it live or you record it on and someone says that it was important to them, that's like when I am absolved of those things. Do you find that too?
Yeah, I mean, therapy can be expensive, but when I sit myself down on the sofa and start writing lyrics, I can find a reason to sort of question things that I don't feel good about, and sometimes they come out in song.
Yeah, me too. Therapy can be expensive, but I find that if you just do loads of podcasts, you end up talking about your childhood anyway. So just get on loads of podcasts. It's free therapy.
Free therapy. Are you one for 50 minutes on the sofa in front of a therapist? Or
I have done it. But then I've got this like weird problem with authority figures. And I kind of should have realigned the way I thought about it in my mind. But then I've also got this, I don't know, I don't want to sound arrogant, but then I kept thinking, well, I'm clever as well. I don't need this because I'm a clever person. And then I'd think, well, I just want to impress this person. I want to be the most depressed person. And like, I don't know, I think I wasn't right for that. It's better for me to write the songs.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then performing them live.
Oh, that's just like something else.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know who the man is that lives inside my body that gets to go and do that.
Mm.
But I'm so glad he turns up.
Oh, what a good way of putting it.
Yeah. One time he didn't turn up quite recently, actually, on our last tour in Bournemouth. We didn't tour Bournemouth. It was just one of the places we went. Yeah. And, he just didn't turn up. And it was me instead, and I felt really exposed and scared and very aware that everyone was looking at me, and just like that whole kind of barrier and the confidence and the character that you can tap into just wasn't there. And I came off stage and I said to the band, oh my God, I'm so sorry. That was awful. I was awful. I really let us down there. And they were like, what are you talking about? Like, it was great. It was a great show. We didn't notice anything was wrong at all. But in my head, yeah, the amazing, confident version of me just didn't turn up.
God, I know that feeling so well, not turning up. It's difficult just to switch into that guy. He either comes or he doesn't. It's kind of like writing songs. The more I chase them, the less they turn up. But if I just sit here in my desk and wait for them, that's the best thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I see myself as like an antenna or something, and the songs are just kind of floating around.
Yeah.
And you just have to be ready to receive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a lovely thing. So what was your first experience of being on stage? Did that guy turn up immediately, or did you have to go and find him?
My very, very first ever one, I was in primary school on a school trip. And me and Stephen Fish sang Strong by Robbie Williams to the rest of the class. And everybody clapped.
Wow.
And I felt that acceptance, like maybe for the first time, because I'd always felt kind of like an alien that didn't fit in with anyone. Mm. And then when everybody clapped, I think that uploaded something into my brain that was just like, this is how you make people like you. And I've kind of showed off ever since, just done it ever since.
And was he your best friend at school?
Stephen Fish. Yeah, he was. He ended up in a band with me. He's a chef now. Yeah. I still talk to Fish.
And what kind of relationship do you have with Fish?
It's more distant now. We kind of went different ways. Like, he's a father and a grown-up, and I'm a child and an idiot. And, yeah, he's very sensible, and I'm very not.
Right.
But we still, you know, we've got that unbreakable bond of having performed for the first time at Low Bank Ground in 1994, or whatever it was.
But surely that wasn't your first record, was it?
No, I was obsessed with Queen when I was a kid growing up. Like
Freddie.
Yeah, just. Mm. I used to watch the Queen Live at Wembley thing religiously every night. And I think it really was because of all the people that were clapping at Freddie. And yeah. just like how much everyone liked him. And I thought, well, I want to do that. I want all those people to like me as well. But I got a bit obsessed with it, like in a weird way. Like my gran Mavis made me the yellow jacket. And, mm-hmm. you know, I used to like draw a mustache on. So it's not surprising that I didn't have many friends apart from Stephen Fish.
Right, yeah. There are very few performers like Freddie anymore, I think. People that can command a stadium.
Yeah, I think just me, really.
Just you. Yeah.
It's just me.
It's probably true. But it seems like, you know, we need you at Glastonbury. We need that kind of Freddie. We need you to arrive and give us that kind of spunk that an audience needs.
Well, I just believe in entertainment, I think. And like, I think like great music is great music. And I love a range of music from like the most avant-garde thing you could imagine to like straight up pop music. But I think in a live gig situation, you need to provide a feeling. Like that's my responsibility. So my favorite one to provide is joy. And I think that is through like sheer entertainment and making people smile and laugh. And if people are laughing, they're having a good time. I actually have this thing where after a show, I'll have our photographer send me all the photos from the back of the stage. And I like just zooming in on people's faces. And then if they've got like big beaming smiles, then it doesn't matter that the fee was bad. Because
with that in mind, does that mean that you follow social media and see what people think of you? Is that important?
Oh, I'm terrible with that. Oh. Yeah, I'm always craving it and chasing it, and it is important, but I'm hypersensitive to criticism and to people being mean. So if you know, there could be 1,000 nice comments and then there's one mean one
that you find. You dig it out.
It'll derail me.
Yeah.
I won't be able to get up that day. It really will.
Really?
Yeah. Like really,
good
really
Lord.
I know. It's really bad. And I suppose like the more successful you get, the more of them there are. Like, you know, if we've done like TV appearances, I can't help but go on Twitter afterwards and then read everyone being really horrible. Yeah, I think it's called rejection sensitivity dysphoria, and it's part of like the ADHD thing. And
sounds like an album title to me.
Yeah, well, that's coming out in 2026, the next number one album from the lottery winners. Why do you hate me?
Oh, no. I used to work with a band called The Stripes, an Irish band.
Yeah, I know them.
And they'd come off stage and they'd all go to their phones to see what people thought. And I, you know, when I was a kid, I used to come off stage. We didn't have phones, so we just had to imagine what people thought.
Oh, yeah. Well, I suppose I would prefer that because in my imagination, I've always absolutely killed it. Yeah, maybe we don't need constant honesty and just constant opinions all the time. It's scary, man. And people, like, when it's anonymous as well on the internet, people can be really spiky, can't they?
Oh, they can, yeah. So what was your first record that you bought?
The first one I actually went out and bought with my own money was Be Here Now by Oasis.
Right, of course. That's the Manchester link, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, they're just from down the road, and that was inspiring. Because they were the biggest band in the world at the time.
Still
and they still, they literally still are, aren't they? It's incredible, this whole tour thing. But yeah, that was an important record to me for that reason. And Oasis were an important band and still are, yeah.
Was Manchester for you a place that you grew up, that you felt comfortable in?
Yeah, me and all my friends used to go and like sit in the centre of Manchester and go to Affleck's Palace. And yeah, it always felt like it's maybe, 25-minute drive away. So I never felt like I was a Manchester kid.
Oh, okay.
But we'd certainly go there a lot. And it always felt like really cool to go to Manchester.
Yeah, wow. I can imagine. I mean, whenever we used to go to Manchester, it was always felt like you were going to a music city. you know, all the clubs would be full and, you know, the venues would be great to play. Although I still have some doubts about the Apollo.
You don't like the Apollo?
Well, the distance from the mic stand to the first people in the first row is like mental. It's like a football pitch away.
You're absolutely right with that, actually, because we did it, was it this year or last year? I can't remember. But I spent the whole time just like right at the front of the stage, completely unlit. Because I was just so far away.
Yeah, of course. And those dressing rooms, I mean, one of them's got an electric fire in it from like 1966.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is pretty dated. It was an important gig for me to do that because that was where I went to my first ever gig.
Which was what?
It's not a cool one, unfortunately. It was Sum 41.
You
know, they're like a pop punk band from Canada. You must know Sum 41.
Oh, God, well, I know of them, but yeah.
Yeah, so that was me around, you know, 12, 13 years old or something, and thinking, oh, wow, I'd love to play here. I'd love to do this. This is so cool. And then, yeah, and then got to kind of headline it.
One of the best gigs I saw at the Apollo was Peter Kay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, I love Peter Kay.
He did an afternoon show there for charity, and it was just like the best gig I've ever been to.
Oh, he's amazing, isn't he? I'd love to meet him.
I'm sure you will.
Have you met him?
Yeah, we're good mates. I met him. He came. So the story is that he used to be a fan of ours, and he stood outside the Apollo waiting to get an autograph, and apparently he offered me an extra strong mint as I walked past him, and he asked me to sign something, and I didn't, and he's never forgiven me for it.
You awful man. It's Peter Kay. He's a national treasure.
I know. And he knows kind of all the Squeeze lyrics and stuff, and it's just extraordinary. And, of course, we did a show with him, a film with him. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, if you could introduce me, I'd be grateful, because the biggest achievement from our band, forget these number one albums and sellout shows and tours and stuff, we actually all went to a Phoenix Nights quiz as a team and wiped the floor with everyone, totally won. And we've got the certificate from that in our studio in like pride of place.
Okay.
We are huge fans.
I'll tell him. Ironing over the first gig, what was the second one? What was the most important first gig that you saw, if it wasn't that one?
The transformative ones. There's been a few, I suppose. I remember being a teenager and seeing Radiohead in Edinburgh, because I'd kind of become friends with some of the bigger boys, some older guys who were in a band that kind of let me join it. And I really looked up to them, and they were all really into Radiohead and stuff. And so I was. And we drove down to Edinburgh to see them in an outdoor situation. I think it might have been a castle or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were doing Paranoid Android, literally as Tom York... And I stole the H out of his name and put it in mine, by the way. As he was singing, rain down, the heavens opened up and it started raining. And I was just like, this could not be like any more perfect. I just cried my eyes out, luckily disguised by the rain. So that was like a really transformative. I think I realized the power of live music there.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a communication like no other.
And a connection. And also, like, it's a one-time thing, isn't it? It's a totally unique. Every time you do a performance, the combination of people in that room and the things that have happened will never, ever happen again. It is like a complete unique situation. And I really like that. I think that's really special that you get to share these experiences.
So when you turn up and that happens, it must be a glorious night.
A lot of people say that every time I play, it's a glorious night, yeah. That's what a lot of people are saying on Twitter, only a couple not.
I'm going to come and see you to see this.
You should. It's we're good. Like, I believe in it. We're a really good live band.
I'm sure you are. Are you at Glastonbury this year?
No, we're not, because we're on tour with Robbie Williams, actually.
You're not?
Yeah, really? We're doing 5 months with Robbie in stadiums.
5 months.
Yeah, so there's a couple of times where I'm going to feel like a proper pop star because we've got to fly, you know, I'll be in Bulgaria and then we've got to fly and do Kendall Calling the next day, and then the next day after that we'll be in Latvia or something. And apart from it being on EasyJet, I'm going to feel like quite the rock star there, I think.
I love Robbie. I adore him.
Me too. We've become really good friends, actually.
Give him my love when you see him next. We used to have the same manager who was like our mentor.
Yeah. Well, Robbie's literally like my mentor now. He's really, my therapist is Robbie Williams.
Yeah. He's in Switzerland, isn't he? I think.
Yeah. He lives between Switzerland, LA and London. Yeah. And if I'm feeling kind of shitty about something, or if I'm nervous about something or not sure what to do with something, he's kind of experienced it all already.
Yeah,
I'm like the, you know, Netto Aldi version of him. And I get to ring him up and he's so kind with his time, and he'll really talk to me, like really, really talk to me about things. And I'm well grateful for that, because my mind always goes back to singing his song with Stephen Fish. And then it's like this full circle moment where we're actually mates. And as you know, he's incredibly funny.
Yeah, and he really is.
Yeah. And I'm always fuming because we have these great chats and I think this could be a podcast series. Why didn't I record that? Everyone would have loved that. I said a well funny thing.
Oh, he's a beautiful guy. There's not many people in the industry like him. And in fact, when we were talking about Freddie Mercury, you know, being able to hold a large audience, he can do that.
Yeah, he is the one.
He is the one.
Yeah, yeah. It goes Freddie, then him, then me.
Yeah. I remember going to see Take That at Wembley when he was in it very briefly again.
Yeah.
All the boys came out on stage apart from him, and there was a big crane above the place, and the opening chords of Let Me Entertain You start, and then he flies in on a rope.
I love that. I love how much of a show off he is. Like, he's just, yeah.
The rest of the band, like, you can't top that. Poor old Gary. He just couldn't do it.
He'll ring me sometimes and not even say, he'll just rap. He'll just like start the, FaceTime. We FaceTime each other and he'll just start rapping. And then I'll just like rap back at him and we'll have like a little rap battle. And our bass player, Kate, was like, oh my God, you are literally the same person. I cannot deal with two of you.
Hi, I'm Chris Difford and you're listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen. Coming up next, I'm answering your questions.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
As promised, I'm going to be answering any questions you may send me on any music-related topics that you'd like a little help with, or just some general advice. I'm not a counsellor, but I'm here to help. I'm going to start with this. This is an email from Kate Collins, who lives in South Wales. Do crowd reactions overly influence your intent to return to a venue? Love, Kate. Well, Kate, not really. I would happily return to a venue if there was nobody there. It just depends on how you can make the stage your home. Because when you're away from home, you have to create home with your audience and with the environment that you're playing in. So it's not really about whether I get applause or no applause. It's about just finding a home on the road. This is an email from Andy Callahan in Chicago. Here's a question for you, Chris. As someone with many road miles under your belt, what's your take on band members, especially more established vintage acts, travelling on separate buses, hanging out in separate dressing rooms, essentially to avoid each other and possibly murdering each other? Well, Andy, it's an easy one to answer. When you're on the road in a band, you know, there are like 5, 6, 7, 8 individuals, and everybody needs their own space. You can't just be on stage 24 hours a day. So I know, for instance, with myself, I can only speak for myself, I do like to have my own space on the bus. I do like my own dressing room because I need to find the spirit that puts me on the stage and the emotion that connects me with the audience. So I think it's very important that if, as you get older, you can enjoy the camaraderie of being in a band by having your own space. Cheers, Andy. Anyone listening, you are more than welcome to send me a question, either written or you can record one. But make sure you send them to chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. That's chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. Thank you so much. I can't wait to see the questions you're going to ask. And I can't wait to fathom out how I'm going to answer them. I remember meeting Johnny Marr in Soho once, and I asked for a photograph with him, and he was a bit sort of standoffish, to be honest. But eventually I got a selfie out of him and a hug. What was it like for you when you met him?
Well, the Smiths were a very important, transformative band for me. They really were. Like, when I first heard Morrissey, I was like, Morrissey's an alien too. And he, you know, it felt like he was directly speaking to me in the song. So the Smiths were so important. Just I've got Smith's lyrics tattooed all over my body. I've got 2 portraits of Morrissey because the first one looked like Rick Astley. He was also cool, by the way. But I didn't want a tattoo of him. The first time I met Johnny Marr, well, I was a kid and we were in Blueprint Studios, and it was the first studio session we'd ever done, the first proper one. My granddad actually gave me some money to do it. He said that he would rather that I had the money while he was alive and he could see me. So I think it was like $2,000 or something, which was the most money I'd ever seen. And we went into Blueprint Studios to record, and we were terrible. And I was outside the front smoking, and Johnny Marr just walked past me, and I was like, oh my God, is this what it's like in recording studios? Just all kinds of Johnny Marrs walking around. And I kind of followed him in, and he went into the kitchen to make himself a coffee or whatever. And I turned on the tap and it exploded out and went all over me. And I was like, this is so embarrassing. I just done that in front of Johnny Marr. And he was like, hey, mate, do you know where Tim is? And Tim was the guy who was recording us.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, he's in Studio One. I'll take you through. And then so, like, all of a sudden, Johnny Marr was in the studio listening to the guitar parts I'd just put down that were soloed at the time. And I was like, oh, my God. And I went to the back of the room and took a picture on my phone and I left the flash on.
Okay.
And it kind of illuminated the whole room. And he turned around and he wasn't happy.
Nah.
He was like, you can't just take pictures of people. Like, just because I'm Johnny Marr, you wouldn't do that to someone at a bus stop. And I was absolutely devastated. Like, people in my family had died and I'd felt better. You know, like, because it was Johnny Marr. He was my hero. Yeah. He was in the Smiths. Mm. And I was like, I don't know, 20. And it was just devastating. And it really, I was so upset that I don't, because he like left and I was just kind of sat there sad. But luckily I had this like redemption moment where I went back into the kitchen and he was there, and I was like, Johnny, I'm so sorry. Yeah. About it was just a really big deal for me. You know, you're in the Smiths, my favorite band of all time, and I couldn't believe that you were here, and it was the first time I'd ever recorded. And he was like, oh no, I'm sorry. I know you're not a bad guy, and he gave me this big hug, and then he gave me loads of advice about kind of not following trends, and he said what we were doing was really good, and that's he was great, like, just stick to what you're doing, and you'll go far. Kid kind of thing. So I did have like the redemption moment, but for that kind of 10 minutes my whole world ended.
Oh my god.
So yeah, nice one, Johnny. That was a roller coaster. I've met him since, and he was equally as standoffish, just bit of a knob.
How do you deal with the well-being when you're out on tour? Does everybody in the band look after themselves?
In different ways, I think. I'm sober now. Have been for... In August, it'll be 4 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, mate. So that helps. That helps a lot with the old mental health. Not waking up feeling rubbish is very important. And yeah, we try and kind of stay fit. We all bought gym memberships at one of the ones where you can go anywhere. But I suppose we just actually have to go. That would be like the next step.
I draw the line at the gym, I'm afraid.
Do you? You don't want to put shorts on and sweat around people?
Not at the moment, no. I'm in recovery too, so that's something that I kind of prefer to get fit from.
Yeah, definitely. I found that, like, just going out for a walk, I think when you're touring, you can just sometimes see the bus and then the venue, and then the bus and then the venue, and you don't get to see anywhere. But I always make sure I go to the local market and just have a walk around, or go to a park and just, like, have a little walk, take some time out for myself, like, on my own, an hour, go for a walk around, and I always feel really refreshed then.
And it's great to be with Robbie because he's sober too. So you can have meetings backstage, you know, and lean on each other.
Yeah, we've got a lot in common. Like we really have. It's really refreshing to have him as like a mentor kind of figure, because there's loads to talk. And dealing with like ADHD, which we both have and both are hard unmedicated on, just raw dogging. It's like, that's important as well, just to have somebody I can talk to about feeling overwhelmed or, yeah, all the different things that come with it.
Are there any side effects to the medication?
I've come off it now, but when I started, I did a few titration periods, and it's like an amphetamine. So I was really chatty and talkative, and the voices, not the voices, I don't want to sound like insane, but everything that was going on in my head did quieten down.
Yeah.
But then I feel like I just kind of lost my spark, and then I'd have this like massive come down late afternoon, and I'd just feel really depressed. So I was like, oh, I'm not for this. I'd rather be who I am.
So many kids that I know are on medication now that cost a fortune, it seems to me.
It did. It was. And I think that's wrong as well. And the waiting times for the diagnosis it's like up to 8 years.
I know.
And that's like someone's whole school.
It is.
And I know that if I wish I had that diagnosis at school, because I think things might have been different, and I wouldn't have been just labelled like the naughty child or a bad person or broken. And, you know, I used to literally have to sit in like a cell. They called it isolation. Yeah. And I'd spend like all day just on my own in a cell. Just like, you can't do that to a kid with ADHD. It's like the worst thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was other things. I was wildly creative, like, push that.
What about writing lyrics? When did you first start doing that?
I was doing that at school. I had this real transformative experience in school because I hated it. I really hated it. It made me so anxious every day. It felt like every day I was inevitably set up for failure.
Right.
Because I knew that I couldn't do it. I couldn't sit in the classroom and listen for 2 hours or an hour about Pythagoras. Like, it just wasn't interesting to me, and I'm literally like allergic to boredom. I couldn't do it. And but there was one teacher called Mr. Asprey, Rick Asprey, believe it or not, who never gave me up. Yeah, that's his real name. And he gave me like the school guitar and said, you know, take that home. You're in the school band now.
Wow.
And I was like, what do you mean, sir? I don't know how to play. I can't do that. And he's like, just take that home, learn it. The first rehearsal's next Tuesday. You're in the band. And just like that one act from him changed my entire life. Like it became my entire personality. Mm-hmm. I met my friend group, you know, and now I'm talking to you. And that's a straight line from that moment where he saw something in me that no other, because no one else wanted anything to do with me. But he really took the time, and I'm so grateful to him for that. Like, I list him up there with my biggest heroes, really.
Yeah, well, I had the same kind of thing happen to me, whereby all the teachers, you know, I was writing lyrics on the back of my school book, and teachers would sort of whack me around the head and say, can't you concentrate, and all that stuff, and what's this rubbish you're doing? And then one teacher comes in, an English teacher. He's a stand-in guy. He's only in there for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And he reads the words on the back of my maths book, and he goes, this is great. Have you ever thought of doing anything with these? I go, no one likes them, you know. He said, and then he goes to the record player and he puts a Bob Dylan album on, and suddenly the penny starts to drop that maybe what I'm writing could be a song.
Yeah, wow. Isn't that just so incredible, that kind of chance thing?
Mm.
And then look at you now, man. Like, look at the songs you've written. That is just so wild.
Well, we've both sort of had similar journeys, but in a different way. But when I interview lots of people, they all had that struggle early on at school where they would write stuff to try and express themselves because no one would listen to them.
I wrote a poem in primary school, actually, I've just remembered, about Freddie Mercury, and it ended up getting like published in a book.
Great.
So maybe I've always had that, like, that writing thing as well. I remember the last line was, I'm going to get the date wrong, but I think it was on the 24th of November, 1991, the King of Queen lay down and died. The show must go on. I was like eight or something, so I was like...
That's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
I've always been brilliant. It's just that no one noticed for so long.
I know. When you did play Glastonbury, apparently you played there quite a few times in one weekend.
Yeah, we did six.
My God.
Six shows. I actually did seven, which is the world record. The rest of the band did six. But I was walking past a tent and it had like instruments in it, and I went in and I picked up a bass guitar, and then loads of other people kind of wandered in and got on all the other instruments, and it was like a jam thing. And then the whole place filled up, and that was my seventh show. But last year we just did one. But the year before was six, and I'm never doing that again. I didn't see any other bands. I was just kind of stressing and going between stages.
What was the biggest stage that the band played on?
None of them were like huge. I don't know. Probably just left field, I think.
Oh, okay, yeah.
For some reason, like, Glastonbury haven't woken up to us. We're playing like the main stages at a lot of the major festivals. And, you know, just give us a telly slot, Emily. What are you doing? We deserve that. I got two number one albums.
You're right, you should, yeah.
Yeah. But we're not doing it this year. And then it's off next year, isn't it?
So. Yeah, but I'm sure Chris Martin will turn up.
How could he not?
How could he not?
He'll turn up in an eco-friendly way, though, I'm sure.
Yeah, but he's one of those guys also that can hold a... You know, when I saw him at Glastonbury last year, I think it was, you know, I wasn't sure about Coldplay and their songs, but then I watched him and I thought, wow, there's not many people that can hold that many people in the palm of their hand. It's a real art.
Yeah, yeah. Freddie, Robbie, me, then Chris Martin. You know what? Those first two Coldplay albums are incredible. And if you've not sat down and listened to Parachutes, that's the first one, isn't it? Go and do that. It's incredible songwriting. So good.
Yeah, I'd love to meet him. I don't know why, but I just would love to have that experience. Seems like a lovely guy.
He does. Very lovely, very interesting. I want to meet everyone famous. That's what I want to do. It's crazy because, like, when we got that first number one album, I felt like a door kind of did open into, like, the world of my icons. Like, you know, I made friends with Noel Gallagher, which was wild, and just, like a few other people that I've now got in my phone book, which makes me feel very cool. Sometimes I'll sit on the toilet and just go through my contacts and go, wow.
I hope you've got Elton's.
No, I haven't, but I think he'd love me, honestly.
Of course he would.
A lot of people say I look like a very young version of him.
He'd love it even more.
Introduce me. I bet you know him, don't you?
Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
So America, is that in your orbit?
I'd love to make it more in my orbit. We've done little bits in America.
It's hard work over there.
Oh, yeah. If Robbie can't even do it, what chance have I got?
Yeah, he had a bash at it, but it's like when the Jam went out there, like, they just didn't get it, you know. It's not their vibe.
Yeah. I feel like Americans would love me, because why wouldn't they? I'm very nice. The music's great. And the very, like, limited things we've done over there have gone well, but it's so big. It's just such a huge market.
And it's expensive to tour there now as well.
Oh, really expensive. Impossibly expensive. It's almost impossibly expensive to tour in Europe now, which is a major part of any band's career, isn't it, really? You can't just tour the UK all the time.
No.
You need to have other places to go. And yeah, it's very expensive and very difficult to tour everywhere now. It's a broken industry, the music industry, and we're all just trying to find ways of adapting, I think.
It's really clever that you say that. It's kind of broken, isn't it? I can't... when I was a young kid getting a record deal, they were like parents to us. You know, they were looking after us and making sure we were making records and giving us advances. But now you can't... It just doesn't work the same way.
No, it feels like music's kind of become a bit disposable.
Yeah.
Whereas it used to be such a special thing. I mean, the music industry has had to adapt so many times over the years, from like when some clever guy, I don't know, probably Einstein, first invented recording the music. Everyone said, well, that'll just kill all of the live performances if you can just listen to it at home. But obviously the record industry was born. And then after that came cassettes, and everyone said, well, if you can just record it straight off the radio, no one's going to buy the records. And then everybody adapted, and it changed again. And then, you know, CDs came, and then Napster, all of that, when Lars Ulrich out of Metallica invented Napster, I think, and then pirating became a thing, and everyone was like, well, that's killed it, because no one's going to buy music, you can now just steal it. And then Daniel Ek from Spotify came along and said, well, I'm going to do the pirating thing, I'm going to charge a monthly subscription, I'm going to make it really convenient. So then everybody went and did that, and I think we're just kind of waiting for the next adaption. Like, we just need to adapt now to a place where it looks and feels like artists are important, and that they're actually making a sustainable career, because there's stories that need to be told.
Help Musicians is a charity that's been going for over 100 years, started by Edward Elgar, and the reason he started it is because one of his mates, a violinist's family, didn't have enough money to bury him, so they did a whip round. And they got the money together to help. And ever since then, it's been an incredible charity. During lockdown, it gave over £20 million to young, struggling writers.
Yeah, including me.
Really?
Yeah. I had to get some grants from Help Musicians. It's been, what an incredible charity. It really is.
It really is. It's extraordinary. You should be an ambassador for them, Tom. I think you'd be brilliant.
I accept. I will be the president of Help Musicians.
Okay.
That's what you said, right? President.
I said president, yeah. And I'm just going to phone the workshop and get a throne built for you.
It's now called the Tom Rylance Fund. I would love to be an ambassador of it. I don't really know what that means, but I'd love to do it. It really helped me, and I feel passionate about helping most. I don't want to sound like there's any classism or anything like that, it's really difficult to make it in the creative arts when you come from a working class background. It just is. It gives you so many barriers that you've got to overcome, and I'm quoting Danny Dyer here, of all people, so if I get this wrong, blame Danny Dyer, not me. But he said that only 7% of the creative arts were from working class backgrounds, and I think that is crazy. Mm. Like, working class people have great stories to tell.
The best stories.
The best stories. I've got the best stories. So, yeah, like, that is something that I am well passionate about. So if there's anything I can get involved with, I'm in.
It's the giving back that is important.
I didn't know I had to do that. I don't want to give back. I just want to look good.
Tom, thank you very much for your time. It's been a delight talking to you. I'm going to get on to Peter Kay immediately and tell him that he should contact you.
Please do. We'd be great friends. And, mate, I've loved talking to you as well. A lot of people are saying it's better than Sting.
Yeah.
Are we friends now? Can we be friends?
Yeah, let's be friends.
You can have my telephone number and I will look at you in my phone while I'm on the toilet and go, yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Well, I really enjoyed that chat with Tom. What a great, wide-ranging discussion it was. Therapy, Robbie Williams, the Manchester Apollo, and Johnny Marr, just to name a few things. And of course, I would try and hook him up with Peter Kay, if I possibly can. I'd love to be in the room with Peter and Tom once they get chatting. Can you imagine what that would be like? Thanks so much, Tom. God bless you on your journey. If you want to know more about the amazing work that Help Musicians does, then take a look at their website, follow them on social media like I do, and please consider donating a little money to the charity. They do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK, changing people's lives for the better. And don't forget, I'm taking your questions about anything music-wise, from writing, recording, touring, and everything in between. Your well-being, maybe. Send your questions to chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. That's chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. And please subscribe to the podcast. It makes all the difference. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.